All right, thanks for getting up. This is, so I can tell you this little story about this fish and what we've been doing. I'm going to start off by, I think, first 20 minutes or half hour, depending upon how much we talk, introduce the biology of the system to sort of motivate the math of how we're modeling a certain part of the system, which is sort of the primary sensory process, the electrosensory information. But since it's such a weird system, I kind of have to give a lot of biological background. First, my collaborators, I came from theoretical physics and didn't do much experimenting, and so I never touched these fish. Kurt Bell and his lab are the ones who do all the work on the fish and provide all the data. And up until a couple of years ago, you know, all the thinking about the fish too. It's a very small community that study this kind of electric fish. There's about 5 groups around the world. So everyone knows each other, and it's really, and they're also very modeling friendly too. So there's several other groups that are kind of modeling along with this fish. Victor does all the slice work, and Claudia and Holly do in vivo work. So it's, what's great about the system is that we have these people working on different aspects, and so we can compare back and forth and try to put the system back together. Theoretical stuff, the other theoreticians I work with, Jim McCollum brought me into neuroscience. She does motor control mostly. Jerry Magnus is, he's done a lot of numerical studies of calcium handling in cells, and we're going to work on some spike timing plasticity sort of mechanisms, try to work with that. And Todd Lean, who I've started working with, who's done a lot of artificial learning networks, and so we're applying some of those techniques that he's used there to this system.
Why are you collaborating? Is this your favorite?
That's tough. I can tell you he's my least favorite. All right. Tell you about that first one you saw was the one they actually work on. These are a bunch of others, and this is kind of show there's a lot of fish that have electric, they have electric organs in their tail and give out a little sharp pulse. And this is, they make up about 20% of the species in sub-Saharan Africa of fish. And so I kind of throw this up there just to say, these are actually a really common fish in Africa, and they're, you can buy them in fish markets and stuff. Now this one is called the elephant nose fish because this is a lower lip that protrudes out here. It has an electric organ in its tail, and its skin is covered by electroreceptors. Now this is, the electric organ is really a modified muscle. So a motor command goes to it and gives a little electric pulse like muscles would, except this doesn't contract and it sort of accentuates the electric signal that would come out of a muscle. It gives a little dipole pulse that flips direction. It's a couple volts, but it's very short. It's a very short pulse. Yes? This. Probably right on the skin.
So with an electrode?
Yeah, electrode probably right across here.
Okay, so in the length direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's, so you get sort of a dipole in one direction that flips and then shuts off. So being a dipole field is pretty short range too. Let's see, yeah, this is just a show, it's polarized and you get that.
Describe it as a point dipole, then no spatial.
First approximation, yeah.
Okay.
They come in different sizes, but they're not really that big. I mean, these fish, they work on them, they're about this long. They can get up to maybe this big, but, you know. And they, I mean, mormorids come in all different sizes and shapes, too. And this is a cartoon of just what this uses this electric pulse and electrosensory system for. It's actually a very elaborate system. It has 3 separate pathways that come in from 3 separate types of receptors. One which is really most exciting, and you know, we keep diving into that a lot and looking at it, and that's a lot of the work in Kurt Bell's lab is focused on that, is active electrolocation. But they send out a pulse and then detect what that signal is through a certain set of receptors. And then any distortions in that from objects around the fish can use to identify that object. And they're amazingly precise about their identification. Gerhard von der Emde does behavioral experiments where he'll occlude spheres and cubes of different materials, and they can individually distinguish capacitance and resistance of objects. And they can identify, big distant objects different or discriminate from small nearby objects. And so it's a very good system.
What's really the angular resolution?
Huh? Well, they have receptors along the skin, so it's...
Presumably they can tell right. which direction,
right? Right.
How small I am can they
Depends where on the skin, because it depends how tight the receptors are packed, actually, I guess.
Depends where on the skin.
Yeah, where on the skin, how tight the... Yeah, that's sort of around their nose, I bet it can be very... I don't really know. I don't know if that's been measured, actually. But I bet you around the head where they're pretty...
What's the function of the object relative to... Function of where the object is, right? Not...
Huh? Function of where the object is.
It's an object, right? It's got to be...
Yeah. It's not that far away. I mean, this shows sort of the range of it compared to the size of the fish. So you can think of it more as whiskers, really. But it is 360. Yeah. So they have receptors all along, and they can even pick up objects here. They don't want to. They'll move back and see it if they're interested in it. Yeah, because they can get a closer look from the front. So yeah, they tend to like scan things and move around them when they're trying to identify them.
And their eyes work?
Yeah, although they are nocturnal, and they can. They do really well in muddy water. So they don't need their eyes, but their eyes work fine. So this is in addition to it. Since they have this elaborate system, they also use it for communication with other fish, and they'll call and they'll challenge them. One of the interesting facts about these little fish is they have one of the largest brain to body ratios of any animal. You know, they're as big as we are, basically 2% of their body. And they use 60% of their metabolisms for that brain, too. I mean, that's partly because they're cold-blooded, but we use like 20% of ours. So they have a very expensive brain. So it's kind of evolved into a lot of very complex courtship behavior in using this electrosensory system and whatever other reasons there are. And then what I'm going to be talking about is passive electroreception. And this you also see in sharks and paddlefish and a whole variety of other things, where they're picking up electrical signals outside their body, like a worm wiggling or something like that, which would be a food source for them. They also pick up other environmental noise like lightning off in the distance. In tropical waters, there's a lot of lightning, so it's something to deal with that they can see. Now, the problem they have with picking up subtle signals externally is that they have their own pulse. And so they want to be able to predict their own pulse so they can ignore it while they're listening to very subtle things outside. And this is the system we'll be looking at, is how the process in which they do that and the mechanism underlying that.
Can't they just stop their own?
They could, but then they're, you know, they're blind in another way. And it's been checked on whether they identify things when they just stop their own. But it's fairly, you know, their pulse is irregular. It's usually about 2 hertz. It can speed up really high rates. But since they tend to use both, you know, it's a matter of detecting before and after. Another issue which comes in is that these receptors that pick up external sources are really low frequency detectors. So there's about 100 milliseconds between pulses where those are still responding. And they respond with a certain characteristic signal to their own pulse. So they'd have to, you know, stop for long enough and then pick up that information. I think it's something that's possible, but they don't choose that way. Nice thing about working on these fish that make them a really good subject is that if you paralyze them, it's a really nice sensory motor system to work on because you can paralyze them with Karari, so it turns off the electric organ, but they still send motor commands to it. So you can use that to trigger a artificial electric discharge. And then you can manipulate that. So you have very good control over sort of the sensory reafferent response and do that while you're recording. And also since they're paralyzed, it's easy to record from. So this is the setup that Kurt has been using for years and several other people do too. So you can get really nice in vivo recordings of changing responses of neurons in the brain that are sensitive to electric fields.
So how do they breathe?
They just aerate them. So just a tube in through their gills. Now this is a recording from that setup that you just seen. It's a raster. These are spikes. Each one of these lines across here, or sets of spikes, is triggered by the motor command. It's to give an electric pulse. So they have something to detect the motor command to electric pulse. The fish is paralyzed. So all there is really just the command going that's triggering this. And this particular neuron is sensitive to electric signals externally. So it goes along, nothing goes on, and then they introduce a artificial signal right at this time here. And this neuron responds with a pause and a burst after it. It's kind of a ring. You can see this goes out longer. This is one of those sort of low frequency responders. And so even though the pulse is very short, this has this long, slow response to it. Okay, so the command is just the motor command to the electric pulse. So you paralyze the fish, and the fish is still trying to electrolocate. Yeah. But nothing's happening. Okay. And so only the command, and you're using that command to trigger. You put just electrode on the tail, and so you can pick up the motor command going to the tail. Yeah, yeah.
This is what this is. So these spike trains are.
So these spike trains are from.
They're aligned on the command.
Yeah, yeah. It's all triggered by the command. So the command is always happening at time zero.
But there is no structure there.
Huh? Right. There's nothing going on.
Okay. So it's not sensitive to the command.
Right. Right. Sensitive. At least not here. And this is the story. Okay. So here he's not sensitive to the command at all. So you turn on. This sort of, it would be replacing the electric pulse that the fish would have.
Is that pretty close to what the fish generates?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for this, they want it to be just pretty much what the fish does. Same delay, everything, just right on the nose. So it responds with a pause and a burst. And then after pairing this for a while, it starts fading away. Huh? Yeah, the sensor. Right, right. And this.
The same distance. The same time
right.
This occurs naturally.
Right. Right. Exactly. So then it fades away. And then you shut off the sensory signal, and now this neuron is responding to the command, where it wasn't before. And it's responding in the command to an exact negative image in time of what that neuron was responding to. So this is a little more complex than just straight out adaptation, where a neuron is.
But you say this combination happens naturally all the time.
Yes, it's so always going on.
Causing this adaptation?
Oh, it is. It is. Because what it's doing is after it adapts, then this neuron that's an electroreceptor, or actually it's a secondary neuron from an electroreceptor, is now not responding to the predictable signal from the fish. So it's a lot more sensitive to external.
This C plus S condition.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all the time natural. No,
right.
Upper.
Uh-huh.
But you still see a pause, so it means that it's like unadapted.
Right here it's
so
unadapted.
Why is it unadapted if it happened a lot before it
did? Oh, well, then here it adapted to no signal. Previously it adapted to no signal. They had the signal shut off for a while.
So this is a fish which didn't do this
for
a long time.
Right. Right, so they had it paralyzed, they put it in, they locked it in, they hooked up all their stuff, put in their electrode, found the cell, and got this. And then they do the pairing, and it's responding.
The question is, what happens when you stop the connection between the command and the actual output?
And then the signal. So then what you see is this. You see the same thing here. You see the opposite. So when you curieize the fish, and paralyzed it. If you were recording from the cell, you'd see this. You see now a response to the opposite of whatever would have responded to that signal had it not adapted to it. So it would have been this, and that would have faded out to nothingness, which is what you got up here. And so you do the pairing, turn on the electric signal again, it's responding, and then that fades out, turn it off, and you get this. So this is a system that's always basically flattening out responses to anything that's predictable.
So if you recorded for this neuron in a awake, behaving, and curarized fish,
mm-hmm.
the neuron would show, and there were no other object around, presumably this neuron would just be dead flat.
Right. And then you put in an unpredicted electric signal, and then you'd see it start doing stuff.
Okay. operate the functions we're given during the conditioning? During the C plus S period,
yeah.
What was the rate of the stimuli?
It's exactly locked with the, well, the rate varies, it's probably about 2 hertz. But it's always locked with, well, they, when they often, I mean, these curieous fish are, they're a little slow responding and changing, but usually whenever anything funny happens, like a signal goes on and off, they speed up, and they call it a novelty response, and usually when some new thing comes in, and actually any disturbance in here, the fish speeds up its rate of electric pulses. And it's like it's, you know, trying to get a better look. And so it kind of speeds it up because it's really getting all snapshots when it's identifying objects. And so, okay. All right, and this is kind of an engineering way. I don't know. This works for some people. It doesn't really work for me, but it was around before I came, so I still show it. These are the three different systems. The one in the middle is the one I'm talking about, and it's just sort of another way of explaining what I just said. Electric command gives a signal, goes to down the spinal cord to electric organ, gives a discharge, goes into these ampullary receptors, these slow responding receptors that are tuned for external sources, that goes into this neuron they're recording from. Now, to get the response that we just saw, that adaptive response, it means that there should be some other connection, call it a corollary discharge, that goes by another pathway and somewhere picks up the expectation of what that signal is going to look like, what the sensory image is going to look like, and puts it in. And also this is not just, well, this is also dependent in time too. So through time, following the pulse, it knows it has an image and it subtracts that, so the output is flattened out. Now I'll look at some of the anatomy so you can see these pathways of how this stuff is put together. What they record from in Bell's lab is the electrosensory lateral line lobe. It's connected, this is the tie-in with hair cells. It's the lateral line lobe is a hair cell system along the fish that pick up, along all fish, that pick up motion of water around it. And this seems like an adaptation of that system. And it sits in the brain stem. And the primary afferents come in here and they're mapped in from electrosensors on the skin in a somatotopic pattern. And there's really three different sections. All of this stuff is dedicated to the active electroreception. And we're looking at this stuff that's passive electroreception, looking at outside sources.
So each of those is a copy?
Yeah, and each of those is a copy. This is what the ELL looks like in cross-section. Important thing of this picture is that there are a lot of cell types and that it's laminar. And it's called a cerebellum-like structure, mainly because it has a layer of thickly packed principal cells that have dendrites that go up into a molecular layer that meet parallel fibers. And a lot of the analogy breaks down there. But still, there are probably a lot of similarities, and you know, it's sort of part of my interest is because an interest in the cerebellum as well. The cells that we're being recorded from and we're looking at are these, they're called median ganglion cells. And they're very rich along here. These are really Purkinje-like cells, they're GABAergic, they're inhibitory. And they synapse, among other things, onto these output neurons, which are the real output of the system. So in the cerebellum, the analogy, this would be like cerebellar nuclear cells, only they haven't migrated out of the cerebellum. The primary afferents come in through the deep layers and meet a set of dendrites of these cells. And that corollary discharge signal come in through a granule cell layer. It's really a sort of an external nucleus that sends parallel fibers into this. It picks up other things, but the most important here is that it picks
so
up that.
Is the output on the MG cells much, much different than on the actual output cells of the membrane recorded from?
These guys?
Yeah,
yeah.
That's your normal part.
And this, right, right.
What if you record from the output cells?
These?
Different signal?
Yeah, it depends on what part. And the part that I'm showing, they're very similar. So these don't show a lot of plasticity. I don't see a lot of adaptation. It seems like all the adaptation, at least in slice. And so it seems like all the adaptation comes from these guys. That's really why we're zoning in on those. and the active electrolocation system, these do show a very different signal, where these they respond with a burst to every command in that case, and these actually have a varying output. So it's sort of like these really give you just a sort of a varying rate depending upon what the object is outside. All right, so what you're looking at, yeah, it's a cortical sheet that kind of wraps around like this. So this is a slice through it, and you're looking in sideways at it.
There are fibers around one.
Right. So they run, let's see, the parallel fibers run medial laterally, and they actually cross the midline.
And the dendritic trees of these...
They're not so flat as the cerebellum. They're really just pretty clustered here. These fish have, actually most of their brain is cerebellum. And the Purkinje cells in that cerebellum are just perfectly flat. I mean, they leave the mammalian cerebellum just way behind as far as how precisely they're flattened out with parallel fibers coming up. But this part, it seems that they're just really little bunches coming up.
So
but they're very tall.
Quite different from the cells in the cerebellum.
Yeah, the similarity is that, okay, there's molecular layer, there's parallel fibers, they're GABAergic, and there's plasticity. Actually, these are different. The parallel fiber, yeah, actually, you will see these have NMDA, NMDA receptors. Okay, so here's another cross section through the fish. Sagittal section. This is really to show how the two pathways meet. You have from the command nucleus here, let's just sits down in there, and we'll talk about that some other time. But anyway, it sends a little command signal down to the tail, gives a pulse, and the primary afferents carry it into this ELL, which is this purple region. And simultaneously, the command follows this other pathway that comes around to this external nucleus that gives rise to the parallel fibers that drop down in here. So this picture really shows that, at least anatomically, and now recordings have been done in all these different locations, so physiologically as well, you have two pathways, one, a reafferent pathway that's going externally, and an internal pathway that's giving an efferent copy of what the command was and the timing of that command that meet up in the ELL. So it can use this information to make predictions about what the signal will be.
So this, those which propagate this as like a burst of spikes or one spike?
Which, this?
No, we have two commands.
Right.
So what is it?
This is a, let's see. This sets off motor, it depends where you are. Yeah. I don't know about these recordings. These are a series of spikes in the reafferents. It's because they're modulating a signal. Here, this part is...
It's just one axon?
Yeah, here it's one spike. It's a bunch of axons. It's a bundle.
Yeah, but just long axons.
Huh?
Long axons going directly.
Yeah, like yeah. Well, it stops off at a couple junctions here.
There are other neurons?
Yeah. There are relay neurons in there. And this actually would be important, I think, in the next slide to show you. Because in those relay neurons, something is happening to that signal where it comes in, starts off either as I think it's a single spike going back up in there. But then it gets distributed out in time. So that by the time it gets to these granule cells that give rise to these parallel fibers, these things are firing up to at least 80 milliseconds. Pass the command. Some fire immediately with the command, some fire later and later and later. So it establishes this whole series of delays of inputs going in here. Now right now, Holly Campbell is trying to record from these in vivo to really get a good distribution of those delays, because it's something we'd really like to know. It's fairly critical for this model. They've recorded from what we think are granule cells.
And distribution only what is just to know when the command is.
Right. It wants to know where the command is, but it also gives it a bunch of different times after the command. And you'll see why that's important.
Okay. There's like a full recording of time.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, years ago, although this isn't a review article, Kurt Bell looked at this and said, okay, I'm looking for this expectation generator. And he also had a lot of influence from the cerebellum. So you have sensory information coming and stimulating these guys. And you've got command information coming here, and timing information. So the idea would be to look at the synapse and see if that's changing and see if that's helping. Is the mechanism, is if plasticity in these synapses is the mechanism. And so he went into slice four for making that negative image to cancel out, to making that image to cancel the expectation of what the signal would be, to cancel out the sensory information.
But the timing between the command and the stimulus is fixed.
Right.
So that's what you want to cancel.
Right.
You have to learn it once for life. It will never change.
It does. The fish becomes longer. The water conductivity can change drastically, which will change that signal. And just from a tropical storm, we'll wash a lot of mud in the water. That's one thing that I have to keep up on. So there are reasons for it to change, just swimming into different conditions. Yeah. Yeah.
And this is shown to change the timing between command and
distance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the timing is very, very precise, but that response, how strong that response is of that neuron, depends on how strong the signal is at the skin, which is going to change depending upon water conductivity. So, okay, these medium ganglion cells, when you record from soma, or really anywhere in them, they see two types of spikes. As a recording from depolarizing it, one is this small spike, and one is this broad spike. Now the small spike, we're very convinced, is just axonal. I have it here in the soma, which isn't really true, but is axonal and is that spike that communicates to other cells. The broad spike, you kick them off at a higher depolarization, so they have a higher threshold. And they appear to propagate up into the dendrite, so it's a back-propagating spike. And although these are very hard to record from these dendrites, but they've done field recordings across the molecular layer and seen a wave propagate up along with the broad spikes. And so seems to be that would be how the soma would communicate to the parallel fiber synapses about what's going on down here, about sensory input coming in, and how many narrow spikes are coming out. So you have a lot of narrow spikes, and that recording you saw actually had both, but we didn't see it, couldn't differentiate it in that. And you have a lot of narrow spikes and a few broad spikes, because they have a higher threshold. So in the slice preparation, what they had done, they took the slice, they recorded and could stimulate to give broad spikes, and this is the spike timing, basically pairing paradigm for plasticity, which I'm sure, I guess B was here and talked about. I don't know how many people were here then, but so you give a pulse to kick off one of these broad spikes, and pair that with different delays of parallel fiber stimulation. So at some pairings, when you have a broad spike that, say, parallel fiber, broad spike that follows, gives you depression. And other pairings give you potentiation of that synapse after about, I don't know, 300-400 pairings. There's a little rate dependency, but it's not much. It's mostly just how many pairings there's been. Now, if you lay all these different pairings out, what you get is a small window of depression when the broad spike immediately follows the narrow spike. And everywhere else, there's sort of a non-associative enhancement. Now this comes from, this is just a blow up of this section here. This is NMDA receptor dependent. And also, if you put a calcium buffer postsynaptically, you wipe that out and you always get this. So it's pretty much thought that this non-associative part, this enhanced, this potentiation, is completely presynaptic. Whereas this depression is at least initiated postsynaptically. Now, there's evidence that it's also expressed presynaptically because they can reverse each other. That's been shown.
Also expressed.
Yeah, so it is then expressed presynaptically. And also there's some parapulse experiments that show that this seems to operate by changing the release probability. Now, as you've seen before, as you know, there are other learning rules too. And this one's by the B and Poo paper. Yeah, this is the sort of a Pacific Rim convention where when the postsynaptic follows the presynaptic, that's positive. On the East Coast and in Europe, it's the other way around. But this is basically to show there are other spike timing rules, and they're in other systems, and we're trying to find out what they're doing and what their dynamics are and what they're about. Okay, now we get to the modeling. This is about where I start. I'm going to try to write some of this so you can see some of the modeling method used. How do I turn on this?
The light is here.
Ah,
okay. You want to write this up?
I'll try to fit in here. I think I can. Just to give you a quick preview of what I'm going to write up. The model I use is very simple. It's basically a noisy box that gets inputs and has a probability, depending upon what the inputs are, of an output. And you put a couple thresholds for the different kinds of spikes. The goal of the model, oh yeah. The goal of the model is to try to understand how the synaptic plasticity with this spike timing rule, taken together with the delay coming in paired with these sensory impulses, is giving you a cancellation of that negative of that sensory image. Okay.
So the cancellation will be, how will it be expressed?
Will be in a set of weights of the synaptic inputs that will be changing due to that spike timing dependent learning rule.
I don't see where, how will you see the cancellation that will be used, or what will be, how this will be expressed.
You'll see the output will become steady.
Be
yeah. So what you'll have is you'll have an input that gives you a kind of a pause and a burst, and then you'll watch the adaptation happen.
Okay.
And the output.
So you basically will stop responding to the input.
Right.
I'm sure you said that sensory input is excitatory and the parallel fiber input is inhibitory?
They're excitatory.
They're both excitatory?
Yeah.
So how are you ever going to get cancellation?
Uh-huh. You will. I'll show you. Because you can go both ways, really.
You can reduce the amount of it.
Yeah, reduce the amount of excitation.
So you can drop that.
Right.
Cancel the input.
Right.
If I was an engineer,
yeah,
I would just try to find things which I can predict. So I would strengthen the sensory input and the motor input. I would try to get the coincidence detector for that and take this to suppress something else. I would essentially learn on the inhibitor cell and use that to suppress something else. That's not what you're doing. Right? Why is it so complicated?
I don't know, probably where it started, you know, probably because it was a lateral line system that was doing something different, and it evolved into something else.
And also maybe a question on time scale, you don't want to cancel it too fast, right?
Yeah.
You want to cancel it sort of on a slow time scale so that sudden changes, you recognize, you cancel it. If you just took the sensory input and fed it back,
yeah,
and cancel it every single time, you would never be able to
get
it.
Actually,
exactly,
yeah, I have another answer for you, actually,
so
it's even better.
You should be very precise because everything which deviates from your precise prediction will be the signal.
So
this is generating that signal. This is actually generating that.
Learning,
yeah, it's learning. There is actually in the communication section, in the communication pathway, there actually is an inhibitory response that shuts it off. Yeah. But this is still, but in that sense, it wants to hear signals from other fish that are very short and sharp, and so it can shut off its own very short, sharp signal through that pathway. Here, it wants to hear slow, long wavelength external signals, but it's generating through those same receptors long wavelength signals. So it just wants to shut off its own over a long course of time. So actually that doesn't really work for this pathway.
What's narrow spike and broad spike?
So the narrow spike are just axonal spikes, and the broad spikes travel up into the dendrites. And it's just, they're named that because of how they look. The narrows are short, small and narrow, and the broads are big and broad. All right, so.
Right,
exactly. So in the pairing experiments, it's the broad spikes that you pair with. Yeah, because there's no adaptation that goes along with the small spikes. All right, since I'm looking at sort of a repeated signal, I represent time in really two components. Where one is, if you've got as in that raster plot, or say a membrane potential of it, you have these signals that are slowly changing in time, which are really a number of cycles. And so I just call that the time. And here, the time after where the command was, at zero, I'll call X. All right?
That's really time, right? X is time.
They're both time. But this is really what... Huh? Yeah, short time and long time. So we're breaking it up into two time scales. So this is spike generation time, and this is adaptation time. So it's a nice way to separate it. So I have variables of these, and say this is probability. This is, say P, a probability function that there's a spike in the interval I want to put this, make this all discrete for now, where X N is delta N delta X. All right.
But what's the T level there in there?
Huh?
This is at a particular.
Right, during a particular cycle. So during a particular cycle, you have different probabilities of spikes all along. So with this, I mean, you're constantly spiking, basically, unless you're very low. Also have V, which would be a membrane potential, in quotations. And we define our probability function. I'll show you. Here, why don't I take this out of here? I'm just kind of introducing it. I'll show you what V has in it. One second. I'll put V down here. All right. I just wanted to show you there was a V. Now, really what I'm doing here . This is really just a sigmoidal function. Let's see, I'll just draw it here. Which gives me just a threshold, basically. So this would be theta, the threshold, which was, this goes up to, this is P, and it goes up to 1 here. This is 1/2.
And you're the boson function?
Right. Basically that.
So is that a good model experimentally for
these? It's a good one. I want to show you, you know, why it's good in a second. Let's see. Now I should tell you what V is. All right, V is in two parts. There's some sensory part that's only dependent on X, and that would be the sensory input. So that doesn't change. It doesn't change from cycle to cycle. It only changes during the cycle. And another part, which is, I'll just call V epsilon for now. We can call it V parallel fiber. And that is the sum of all the inputs. Weighted, so you have a bunch of EPSPs.
What is the substring? Epsilon?
Okay, yeah, that's an epsilon. Yeah, we'll do it this way. And T. So you have a bunch of synaptic weights times an epsilon. Let's see. Should be an M. And this is some spike function that's saying when XM is. Now, epsilon is.
It should be W sub M, right?
No, because we're summing over both. Yeah, so M is labeling the spikes. In, oh, that should be different. They make that I. This is all going to, I'm going to change its notation in a second. So
you shouldn't pay
attention. Yeah, so you shouldn't pay attention. So W changes cycle to cycle by rules of plasticity. Epsilon is an EPSP. Okay, something's wrong.
You can sum over I and get rid of it. There must be some other index I inside the epsilon. Right now, you can sum over I and get rid of that.
If I sum over I, then I have a whole bunch of inputs.
Bar, right?
Huh?
No,
I have an epsilon.
Use an I
somewhere else. Yeah, I need to hook it with the spike in the I path. There.
What's I?
So I would be the presynaptic fiber. Or you can say the synapse. We'll call it the synapse. And so if there's a presynaptic spike in that synapse, then it picks out.
Which is an M? I can't read it. Xn minus Xm?
Xm minus Xm.
And Si of Xm.
The Xi of Xm.
It's the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the time of the spike.
Yeah. And epsilon is the EPSP.
Yeah. So the moral of the story is whenever there's a spike, you get a bump and your membrane potential that goes into your spike probability.
It must be 0%.
And V0 is just the sensory input. So for each one of these, for every spike in each one of those, you get one of these terms of the W's. And it spikes. And the neuron responds to that spike with a change in its output probability by epsilon time after. So this is akin to, and actually really is, Gerstner's spike response model. So it's saying that you have a neuron, which is a thing that responds to spikes by changing its output probability. So you send in spikes. And when there's a postsynaptic spike, I don't reset in this case.
Hold on.
All right.
I see it's the same. Okay, so you do that, like you DDT, and there's some delta function term you just integrate.
Yeah, so it's an integrated integrant fire. Without the resets.
It's not leaky.
Well, the leak is built in here. So it's an integrated integrand fire.
All right.
I wanted to show you this just to give you sort of a spectrum because I didn't reset these because the recordings I looked at didn't reset. And I was kind of naive and didn't even know about integrating fires and resetting membrane potentials and stuff. Recently, just this year,
There's no reset.
Yeah, there's no reset here.
And there's no spikes.
Yeah.
No threshold.
There's thresholds.
No trampling.
Right. Yeah, there's no trampling. So you just come up to basically highest output. So the frequency output is really just the membrane or the spike probability. It's related to the spike probability, depending upon your bin width.
When the spike happens, nothing happens. When the spike occurs, nothing happens to the moment.
Right. And this is really in a spectrum of different neurons. And this paper, and they actually go comparing a couple neurons in different places. So this is Hauser and Stewart, or maybe, how do you pronounce his name? I dropped off the umlaut here. But, where they went comparing the resets of different neurons, basically Purkinje cells and pyramidal cells. Yeah, the resets following the reset of the membrane potential. Yeah, following a postsynaptic spike. So they would have an EPSP alone, and then they would give a spike together, and then show the difference. In pyramidal cells, you have a very strong reset, where it comes down to a level that's, you know, within 20%. So the resetting spike response models are an approximation in this direction. Whereas this is an approximation in this direction, which is closer to Purkinje-like cells. It has to do with how big the dendrites are, how fine the dendrites are.
You don't have any reset
in the model. Right.
Why do you say it's a reset of the spike?
It isn't. But I'm saying to reset, if you're doing pyramidal cells, it might be a good idea to reset. If you're doing other cells, MG cells, Purkinje cells, it's a close approximation. It's a bad approximation to reset, that's what I'm saying.
You say this neural don't have threshold? You want to say this is a good model of these neurons?
Not this neuron, but it's a better one.
So this Purkinje cell have no threshold, and when the spike occurs, the voltage doesn't change.
Right.
The point about threshold is a kind of separate part. Here you're making the point about the set.
Right. Okay, so the threshold is?
Well, you don't have threshold. You have spiking occurring at any voltage.
Right. I don't have a bottom threshold. Right. Yeah, so that's not here. Okay.
It's a noisy threshold.
Yeah, it's a noisy threshold. You know, and the noise comes from the 100,000 parallel fibers coming into this neuron. And all the ones that are not related to the command.
This noise coming all the time, not just when the neuron fires.
Right.
So you have this noise here?
That's why this is a noisy threshold.
The voltage here is the voltage relative to this is the voltage minus the noise.
Yeah, there's no noise here.
So this is not the usual voltage. But this is voltage minus the noise. So now if you set the threshold, you have to add a noise, subtract the noise also from the threshold. So you get the fluctuating threshold, which gives you this probability of spiking.
Pretty good way to add noise. The only thing you miss is the reflector thing.
Right.
Well,
you actually have, you have an absolute refractory period. You don't have a relative one.
Oh, you put X, so that's absolute
refractory period in this model. It's just, it's hidden here because, I mean, you have a probability of one. And so your refractory period is, well, then the spike frequency, the maximum spike frequency is one of the refractory period.
Okay,
so you interpret this.
Period in this model, right? I mean, you can, in principle, get smaller time steps.
Yeah, you can get rid of it totally.
So the refractory period is not determined by time steps.
The refractory period is just interpretation of what the probability means. And if you say the probability is, if the frequency is the probability divided by the refractory period, then it's built in. However, you can always have every time step, there's no refractory period in the sense that every time step you have an equal probability of a spike.
Right. Yeah. But you can compare the ISID speed from this model with what you observed in experiments, is kind of pretty close.
And the ranges that we looked at, yeah. Yeah, it works
with this. This is the recording from the cells in the fish. This is done with this.
No, this is Purkinje cells, and these fish cells are very similar to those. Yeah, I could show you another recording that the spikes just hang right on top of the EPSP.
So this model is actually some limits an integrated fire model, but if you have to then assume that the noise varies slowly compared to the spike in the fire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Why slowly?
Because it's not built into this.
The probability of
firing. This is very true.
Change.
Yeah, it doesn't change.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to make this mu dependent on x, say, in order to do something like that. But yeah, it could get ugly. Huh?
What's wrong with
it? I didn't know about
it. Anyway, also, anyway, it's a nightmare. If you try to write down the ISI distribution or anything, anyway, it's a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah.
Why
is it the nightmare?
Go read Nicholas' paper, man. When you have a Riemann zeta function in the middle of the paper, you know that's something. So if you want to find, for instance, the ISI distribution as a function of both noise and it just does. I mean, this is just a.
That's what you want to find.
Well, what I want to find is I want to compute the postsynaptic spike. So I want to know when they are. But I don't want to go resetting. I mean, I can do it on a computer, but I also would like to find the average output.
If you try to write down P of XM for integrating fire, you couldn't do it. Because I couldn't do it.
But he needs it to do simulation.
Well, presumably
it's also analysis, too. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's really what I was headed for.
Well, you're right.
Okay.
Simulations doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. Simulations, you can just plug it in. It's no big deal. Okay, I think we can move on now.
Did you say that it's complicated to write down the formula for the vapor because there's a time limit with noise?
Yes.
So,
the rate's easy.
So, what about the.
If you want to know. Oh, actually, the rate when you add white noise?
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
There's a formula.
There is a formula, but yeah. But now, this isn't white noise, it's colored noise.
This is colored noise.
Yeah. That is colored noise.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, that's funny. So it's doable, right?
Doable.
But in fact, it's doable only if the time constant, synaptic time constant is short compared to the memory time constant, which breaks down almost everywhere. Which means it's really not doable.
So this is sort of another extreme where it's much slower than the synaptic noise is much slower than the.
It's fairly constant.
I would say it would make sense for fast noise also. So PSP is really short.
Yeah, because the noise is constant throughout the cycle. You know, so I think you're right. I mean, yeah, that's, yeah. I mean, I would feel like I would have to be changing this, which is changing this mu depending upon what x was. If I have fast noise going on there, I'd have a function of that, or craziness, whatever.
Okay. Oh, right, because your probability would be jumping all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, learning rule. I've probably seen some of this, but anyway.
Can you turn down this light?
Okay. I'll go back and forth here. Okay. After some delay, one of these synapses kicks off. A delay after the beginning of the command. So I told you that these synapses, these parallel fibers, are responding to the command with a delay in their spike, some immediately following it. Maybe you can look down here. So following the command, and this is this x-axis, same as here, you have a whole bunch of different inputs coming in, a whole bunch of EPSPs adding up. So for each individual one of these, you have, if there's a broad spike that comes outside of it, this EPSP, then that hits this non-associative region of the learning rule, and that EPSP is increased after that cycle. If it comes in the middle, it hits this associative region, where it's now LTD, and this depresses. All right?
So yeah, I'm sure you said this. What determines whether you have a bot spike or a narrow spike?
Threshold. There's two thresholds. So I only wrote one here, but there's really two. Let me show you.
Is it actually true that you have a broad distribution of delays?
Yeah. 80 milliseconds is believable. You know, 80, 100. It's been looked at carefully in the BAT, where of having intersecting inhibitory and excitatory inputs to the neuron, and neurons that can respond with a rebound. So you have the inhibition that comes in, and that holds the neuron down, and the excitation's coming in, so kind of trying to push it up, and then when it comes up, it rebounds and gives you a spike. And so you can get delays up as long as you can get an IPSP. And we don't know if that's the mechanism here, but it was like sort of enough to go, okay. It's not too weird. But there are a couple of relay places where that could happen. It's just a matter of squirting some bicuclin or something in there to shut it off.
This is
anti-heavy. Yeah, this is anti-heavy. Right. Come back here. Now I'll change notation on you. Since each one of these synapses comes in a different delay, we can actually, instead of labeling with eyes and spikes, we know actually when the spike is, we'll just label them with the time that they come in. So now we can go over M, W. So I'm changing that I into an X, M, I believe. Yeah. T, epsilon. Oops. So what I've really done is just basically sum this out. So now there's a different weight. Yeah. So there's a different weight at every X, M, because there's a different synapse at every delay.
We assume that at a specific synapse, the spike occurs always with some delay.
Yeah, or a bundle of synapses. There's an EPSP that's generated at every time step, is what I'm saying.
Omega now is, or W is what?
Is now a function of X and T, because the X is the time step that it begins its EPSP, and T, it keeps changing due to plasticity. Now the rule for plasticity
spikes always occur at a fixed time.
Yeah. So every parallel fiber synapse is firing once per cycle at a fixed time.
You just summed over I.
Yeah.
So I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
The width of epsilon is determined by either the synaptic time constant or the membrane time constant.
Well, both. Yeah. Membrane time constant. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So why does the noise have to be fast? No matter what, epsilon's going to be spread out over.
I think because it's... Yeah, maybe I'm thinking of a different noise.
I would think that...
So which noise are you talking about?
Epsilon sort of wide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The membrane time constant is slow, long, epsilon's wide. With the epsilon's wide, no matter what time scale for this.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it all adds up?
Yeah.
All right.
It works in some way.
Yeah.
Now, synapses are very short, and you still the width of that CSP still stays
Yeah, you mean like, you know, so that kind of keeps going slow.
All right, I think that's all I need. So this L is the this part of the function here. And I add to that this alpha as this. Oh, and L is normalized to 1. So
what's
inside the L? So inside the L is the difference between X broad is when there was a postsynaptic broad spike.
Okay, so that's because you're only going to get adaptation.
Right. So L is this function in here, in this little spot. So when there's a broad spike in there, then L subtracts something from here. And you always have this going on. Alpha is always pushing it up.
So even if there's no spikes that come at all, it gets bigger and bigger.
Right.
Is that a beta or a hard?
That's a beta.
But nothing happens inside, just keep growing.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
When the neuron starts to spike.
And then it starts to spike.
If you kill a fish, it's not inside.
Yeah. But there has to be a presynaptic signal. Nothing happens if there's no presynaptic signal. The synapse stays the same.
Oh, so there's some, this is somehow gated by.
But it's not what.
No, it's not like you're right.
Because you assume that there's a spike.
I assume there's a spike. Yeah.
You assume there's a spike at every accent?
Yeah.
Once per circle?
Mm-hmm.
No, but I mean, that would be.
You can add a function.
No, but back to the statement, I mean, xn is a time step, right?
Oh, yeah, it's time step.
So if you made it, the time step's really small, you don't get lots and lots.
You'd have lots of synapses.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So then.
So you write the equation for only the, for doubling, which is the integrated.
Right. So there's, yeah. So this, if you, you know, if you, you could, this.
You should write the equation for WI, for each time it's separate.
Yeah, but since in this system, all the synapses are activated at the same time delay, I'm just, this is in a sense a change of the labeling, you know, just because I know where all these spikes happen. Yeah. But you can change that too. I mean, you can do Poisson and do the same analysis.
There's no geometry in the synapses. The synapse, which is far away, is one.
Right. Right.
Right.
So the EPA, yeah. Actually, with as this turns out, it wouldn't matter, except that it might change the length of the EPSP. But within that approximation, the far away ones, even if they're small, would start growing by their contribution. And so
we've got some. Xm is the weight of the neuron which fires at the time Xm.
Wxn is the weight of the synapse of the presynaptic spike.
Neuron
the presynaptic. The presynaptic.
So this is the sum of delta
function. Yeah.
You can think of one giant exon. It has to be blocked everything over.
Right. I mean it's W is probably a bundle of it's probably a bunch of them, and they're probably at different places, and they all contribute together. But
so
this is like fine detail.
You go from 1,000 synapses to 20 synapses.
Yeah.
If you can discretize.
Yeah.
Time
right. All right. Eventually I'll squint and go to a continuum, but. All right. So compute the average. We know we have a function for the broad spike. If this threshold is for broad spikes, and we can figure this out. The average change is alpha minus, and yeah, it's just this thing, beta, times the sum of, now go m of L x m minus x n p x. So now this probability will be our broad spike probability. Change it all the way through if we use a threshold for the broad spikes. And so this is really the average change is going to be how many broad spikes you have within that time window subtracted plus this non-associated bit. All right, so I'll show you the simulation and then go back to there. This kind of reminds you what was going on. We had all these spikes, and they're going along, and then you pair with the sensory at the same time as the command, and you get this adaptation where it disappears, and then you get this negative image that comes back. I'll show you the movie that generated that picture of the simulation. Here we go. Well, I'll show you what we got here first. Let's get a few cycles down here. Okay. What you see here, all this is just interface stuff. This is the learning rule, this blue line. When a spike happens after some time that's coincident with the EPSP, which is this red line, and this all maps onto here, you get a depression outside. This is this input, that sensory input, and this doesn't change as T goes along until I get to 100 cycles. This will be a number, and that'll make that go flat. So you can see the adaptation. So I'm starting with the pairing. You'll see a bunch of spikes when the roster is generated by the probability function. This sort of pause region is because we've suppressed V, and here we got broad spikes because we've increased it. And the black ones are the narrow spikes. So we have two thresholds, more broad spikes, which are in red. Anything else? No. Okay, along here, we'll show you then the synaptic weights at every delay following the beginning of the cycle. So this, for instance, this yellow line shows that there's a weight with moderate strength and an EPSP that follows that. And these colors will change as it goes on. Red means they're getting strong. Blue means they're getting weak. So as we move along, here there are broad spikes, and those synapses that had EPSPs that contribute to that region are being depressed by the depression of the learning rule. Here we had few broad spikes, and those are increasing from the non-associated part. Out here, there's sort of a random number of broad spikes, and they're staying relatively flat. Then we get to 100, we turn off the sensory, and now we have more broad spikes here than here, and more than here, too. And so now these that were enhanced are now being depressed, and these are coming back up. So this is the expectation generator. So if you have a series of inputs that gives you something to work with, and that learning rule, then you can, I want to see it again, yeah. Then you can cancel any predictable input. So anything that these parallel fibers are carrying in the EPSPs, anything that's correlated that with that would be a predictable signal, and they can cancel that, or they would cancel it, no matter what.
So there has to be a trade-off between the rate and some kind of instability. You crank the rate up too high, doesn't work at all, right?
But
actually,
the rate is the final rate is determined by these guys.
Right. But if you make it really big, you step and you overshoot or anything.
Well, if you make alpha really big, then the thing just keeps going up.
You make them sort of both big and the same. I mean, you must just balance to make them work.
Well, I'll show you. So let's find a fixed point. All right. Fixed point would be when that doesn't change. Do I have to go? I don't even have to go to continuous yet. So, of course, the easy one is where P is constant. I mean, it's easy because we see it happen. So if P is constant, and this thing is, So then, let's see. We'll say this equals alpha minus beta. We'll say P hat, because we norm that to 1. And then P hat equals alpha over beta. Ta-da. Yeah. So that's your constraint. You know, if alpha is too big, then it doesn't work. But the reason is that alpha is so big that that there's
alpha
no depression.
Beta, right?
Yeah, alpha has to be less than beta.
Can be bigger than one.
Yeah, no, it can't be bigger than one.
This is probably a period of time.
Yeah, yeah.
From that you get W.
Mm-hmm. And then you can solve for W's through here.
So wait,
so you get all your doubles.
P should go to zero at delta X is zero. Right?
P should go to zero as delta X goes to zero.
Otherwise,
well then,
your
yeah.
Actual flying rate is zero delta.
This is the and this is the continuing limit, which I haven't finished doing. it's doable, and I just haven't done it, really. But yeah, it can be done. Gerstner sort of plucks a probability density out of the air, and uses that, and then can integrate that to get this guy. But he gets a different form that, you know, isn't really, you know, intuitively clear why that form.
Well, I mean,
but you know, it's all
works. By delta x and keep track of delta x.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
you
it's
do. It's very. I think it's
like
grad school work. Yeah, yeah. It's just, you know, crossing all the T's. Really.
So, could you explain simulation again? I mean, because you start out with the synaptic weights being uniform, and then you end up with the synaptic weights being uniform.
Right.
So why did you do it?
So halfway through, okay, because halfway through I shut this thing off. So I'm really simulating what the experimental paradigm was.
Okay,
we turn
so
on.
That at this very moment,
right.
Something which is red on the left, blue on the right.
Okay, yeah, so we'll just stop here. Oops, I went too far. Yeah, I should have stopped 4 steps ago. But anyway, the important thing is right here, you have a cancellation of what that signal was. And that cancellation is encoded in these weights.
Okay, so do you have a simulation where you had the thing that we were actually trying to notice. So this shows that your network can ignore itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a similar simulation where you've got
this. Well, you got some little thing outside.
First, that's the
yeah.
Because the initial conditions were flat, right?
Right.
It's like it was flat for a long time and you went to.
Yeah. Yeah. So back this up. Okay, so this is as if you had the sensory stimulus turned off for a long time and just turned it on. Okay, so you're adapted to nothing sensory happening. And so it's very sensitive now to that signal. Now it turns out that that signal happens to be exactly correlated with this whole series of inputs. And in the model of the fish, that's because it's the command that's creating this series. That's also generating the signal. So, and then it adapts to that, and it goes away. So then the reverse is when I shut this off to show that the negative image appears up in the spike train as well as in the weights.
So if you keep, now, so this is my question, if you keep making A and B bigger together, do things just adapt faster to something eventually get worse?
Alpha, beta, alpha and beta?
Yeah, alpha and beta.
Yeah, you can just make them bigger and bigger and bigger. And it'll come to the same spot. What happens is, of course, every broad spike starts really whacking the thing. You know, so it starts looking really noisy, and I think our assumptions about the noise start breaking down. Yeah, but you can really, yeah, you can, you know, it starts.
Yeah, actually, it wouldn't be noisy.
Yeah.
Bigger
yeah, yeah, because then, these weights are fluctuating fast within the cycle. Of course, they only give one spike during the cycle.
So the spacetime between speed at which it adapts and fluctuations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It seems so. I mean, that's actually this project with Todd Lean is to really look into that with more detail. To see if that, you know, if it's really has come to a really nice solution, you know, some optimized solution to that. You know. I mean, this adaptation is really about the same rate as our vision adapting light and dark. It's kind of, you know, it's few minutes, really. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the problem waiting to happen or waiting to be solved. Really. All right.
Who's your favorite collaborator?
Huh?
Favorite collaborator.
Yeah. Where are we? I don't. Should we break yet or keep going? I don't. We can keep going for. Yeah. Why don't I show you? Why don't I show you the other learning rule? Now this is. We've pretty much talked all about this. This is the way it's distributed evenly at the beginning. They have a certain distribution as if they've adapted. Then it changes, and you can see the weights change. And it's just is really sort of a raster plot of the weights and change down, and they come back. And actually, with Todd's help, we can compute this distribution now too, which is cool. Now we mess things up here. Now this blue line, you see, I put in that other learning rule from Moomin Koo and Markram Sackman that we've seen, where now you have associative, and when the broad spike follows, and depression previously. Everything else is pretty much the same. I've taken down the noise a little bit, just so it's clear what's going on. But and of course you get something different. Not so ooh ah, but you know, you can see how it changes. Yeah, you see that here's depression because these EPSPs follow, or the broad spike precedes these EPSPs, so you're in this region. And here, these contribute there, so it's in this region. So these get bigger. Away we go. So if you have a series of inputs correlated with some signal, it emphasizes that signal. Press it down here, but also you get this drift to the left. And that drift to the left is because this is not exactly a Hebbian learning rule, but it's a differential Hebbian learning rule. And I shut off this, and you'll see this keep going. So this would be a neuron that began by firing late in its cycle, and then by the time a bunch of pairings and get this thing started, it starts firing at the beginning of the cycle. So it's the kind of conditioning.
Right.
Yeah, some of that's tuning, but it doesn't really fire. These saturate. I mean, these just basically saturate out.
But the learning rule is not scalar.
Right. For this case, and that would be the next point. I don't know if we need to go into that in any detail. Maybe I'll just talk it out and say what you can do from here. You can take P and expand it around its fixed point and insert that back into this expression and then put in some ansatz for W. Basically, that there's a decay of W, that it comes down to some level, and then have something that would show you instabilities, basically oscillations at different frequencies. And then you can actually solve, put conditions on the length of L and the length of epsilon on when it's stable and when it's not stable, and what kinds of instabilities you have.
For arbitrary.
Yeah, for an arbitrary learning rule.
So what terms of the learning, what in there determines, it's the alpha minus beta
form. Yeah, alpha and the L.
Yeah, so you put any form on the right and do the analysis.
Yeah, you can do the analysis, see if it's stable. This is unstable. You know, and really there's a small class of stable ones. This is a way to look at simulation. This is these two inputs. The red one is V0 after adaptation. The green one is V epsilon. They add up to some average level, which is V, and gets put in. And you get constant spike output. As the system is adapting, right, this V, this membrane potential, flattens out. And this is just really basically the stability issue. So you see this decreasing, coming down. Here you see the pause and the burst. As you come down here, it's totally flat, and here the fish would be most sensitive to external sources. It's eliminate all the predictable stuff, so they're not interfering with it. Turn it off, you get the negative image, and this decays to its fixed point. Other ones start messing with the learning rule, and you start messing with this stability. This is sort of what Kurt expected to find in this, and he was very surprised when he found that it was an asymmetric rule. But the reason it has to be asymmetric, not just the mechanistic explanation, it's NMDA receptor dependent, but in a theoretical reason, is that this is unstable and you can't get a good negative image. You start getting oscillations. You can't see them that well, except you can see in the blue-red here.
If you can't say, well, just because there has to be a delay in order to predict. I mean, you're trying to make sort of non-trivial filtering.
It's unstable because you're changing the spikes at a different place. You're changing the weight at a different place from where they're generating, where they're contributing the spikes. So that's what makes it unstable. So, all right, look at it here.
To the right, it'll also be unstable.
Yeah, yeah. So this one flipped across the origin. These here are now depressing these spikes and not depressing the depressing these weights, but not depressing the ones that are contributing to them. So they keep getting bigger. And these get smaller. So you get these oscillations. And this is that same sort of decay curve for different learning rules along here. This is the one that's in the electric fish, and it's the best candidate of all these other learning rules that, you know, are just done here. Let's see. The blue one does pretty good, but if I let this run for a couple, well, about 1,000 more cycles, this takes off as the oscillations build. And then you have these other ones, you know, flipped and stuff.
But that flipped perspective doesn't work in the infinite time limit, may not actually be relevant to the fish.
It would be, because the fish is still going to be pairing its command, its signal with its command always. It's still going to be pairing that electric discharge with the command. So it'll be basically, if it was unstable, it would be blind to everything externally, because they'd just be seeing its own internal dynamics.
It takes a long time to build up. You start with distribution.
Yeah, but you could start anywhere, too, and it'll
if
still...
If you start off with any random distribution, then it would take off much faster. And once it's locked into some
oscillation,
it will stay there.
Right, right. Actually, that's true. Very good. And so you can classify all these. I mean, it really is just an instability classification of, I don't know, symmetries of the circle, because we're just talking about x here. This cancels, very small group, you know, class. The constraints, well, I'd have to define these things.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
No, I just can't see the violet, the blue.
Can you turn off the light?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so the question is, so this scaling mass is a linear as you Fourier transform, and you find out what eigenvalues go. And
that's
so
basically
you can sort of write down a simple expression. I mean, not now, I'm just curious.
Yeah, yeah. So. Depends, I mean, whatever you use here, I mean, it's kind of, you can do it.
Right.
I mean, you know, and it's a pretty simple expression if you, you know, just
so
say a few things are the same.
True for a purely feedforward system, where you
yeah.
can just once, you have a... Only this sort of limited situation,
mm-hmm,
you have a bunch
mm-hmm.
of input lines and
mm-hmm.
manifolds just
right.
once.
Right.
And you have a postulatic neuron which sums it up linearly and finds the quotient
mm-hmm. Right. Right.
You can select, you can say that there's only one basically in a rule which makes this statement.
But it's also, I'm sure you don't have to assume that it's the fire you take more into the recycle.
Mm-hmm.
The prisoner, you can add noise there.
You can add noise.
Add noise and
yeah.
during the time of that spike.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have instead for this input, if you have one big Wampen synapse and you just give it Poisson presynaptic, you can do a similar analysis and come up with the same result. For this learning rule, it actually really favors this output. So it sets the output. And this would be, I think, now's a good place to stop. And if we want to, we can go on to start putting recurrence in, stuff like that. It's kind of the next thing. All right. Yeah, I don't know. Do you want to? Yeah.
Are you a theorist or an experimentalist?
yeah. Well, I'd.
So you have a lot more or just have a little bit?
Let's see.
If you don't have too much, I would prefer just to go ahead.
Why don't we... What time is it?
Quarter to 11.
Quarter to 11.
Why don't we just continue?
Okay, I'll just continue. And maybe we can...
So
I hope it doesn't confuse you too much.
So how fine is this stable role, I mean, you change your width, I mean, width, is it robust or anything?
Yeah, what I've drawn here is, if this were L,
maybe you find being great.
Yeah, get five. I can get some water. Yeah, 5 minute breaks become 15 anyway.
Yeah.
It's pretty constrained. It can be like about, I think, I don't know, 4 times longer.
Oh, four? It's a factor of 4?
Yeah, it can be longer and no shorter. If it's shorter, it blows up.
Okay, so you can make it twice as big and it'd be a huge range. Okay, so that's pretty robust in this case.
Yeah.
But you use that length because that's the measure experimental.
Yeah.